Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live event called Talking Volumes. In early October, poet and author Saeed Jones sat down with NPR reporter Brant Williams for a conversation about Jones's memoir called How We Fight for Our Lives. Here's Brant Williams.
As Jeff mentioned, I did grow up around here. I used to play sports at McRae Park and used to eat a lot of enchiladas over at Pepito's, which used to be next door for several decades. My guest tonight, though, has done a little lengthier trip down memory lane. And he's emerged with a pretty fascinating memoir. So let's just bring him to the stage, Saeed Jones.
You say good man?
Welcome, welcome. Have a seat.
Hello, hello.
So I'd started following you on Twitter, and
welcome to hell.
Yeah, right. The ferocity. So that's my question. I want to ask you, what is ferocious about you?
I picked the ferocity because it, you know, it means wild, feral, and when I started this Twitter account in, I don't know, 2009 or so, I was really frustrated with the idea that the way black gay men appear in media, and this is changing. But this idea that we are kind of like a queered magical Negro, we show right. up with wit and sass and verve and girl, let me do your hair and you need to don't let him treat you know that
like the character on a TV show
totally and, you, yeah. and you know particularly you know as a kid growing up in the 90s you know that was if there was a black gay character in any TV show or film that was the character, but you know glitter can cut. and you know, I'm very much a Sagittarius. I've always valued, you know, the journey. And I don't just mean travel, I mean traveling from one idea to another. I can talk to you about poetry, we can talk about drag queens, we can talk about Alexander McQueen. Girl, Ukraine, how many whistleblowers? Ann Carson, Marlon James, have you seen this hot guy? You know, all of that and the code switching, you
right.
know.
Well, I'm gonna ask you some more yeah. about code switching too, and especially because it comes up in the book. But
yeah,
wait, you mentioned everything that's in your Twitterverse. So
much.
I was going to ask you. I mean, why do you follow the people you do, and what are some of the things that you pay attention to?
I mean, one of the joys, especially from the beginning, was being able to follow not just media organizations, but the journalists themselves. You know, being able to follow Rebecca Traister, for example, or Emily Nussbaum or Roxane Gay, you know, and not just get the work, but to get some sense of the context. And, you know, and this is, you know, now I'm a decade into this, so it's all different. But that's what drew me to it. Yeah. And yeah, so I still love that. I like the medium. I think it's actually perfectly made for a poet.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. And as a poet, I mean, yeah. you're putting ideas and you're expressing that, and now it's more than 140 characters.
Right, which I remember being like, I don't know, y'all. I don't know. That's too much power. But no, it was the delight of the challenge,
right.
You know, initially. How many ways can I express myself in 140 characters? And what can that compression, what kind of creativity will be created by the compression,
right.
by the limitations? And yeah, it's really fun. And so if you follow me on Twitter, you know, I'm code switching. I'm using like stage directions. I'm always trying to play with it, to change it up, to keep it interesting for me, to earn people's time.
Well, and that's,
yeah.
And one of the reasons why I brought that up is because reading the book about you is this young black queer boy in this mostly white suburb of Dallas and isolated in many ways. And you know, looking at the way people use social media these days, some people right. find their tribe through mm-hmm. social media.
Yes.
Others are further isolated by it. I'm mm-hmm. just curious where you stand on that spectrum of, you know, social media bad to social media pretty good.
I just think social media is human. I think it certainly, you know, my issue is actually with a lot of technology is limited vocabulary. You know, we don't really like have language. I have deep friendships. Actually, Marlon James is in one of my group texts, you know, and he now, you know, mostly is in New York, so I see him a lot. But I have a lot of friends that I have going on a decade-long relationship with, and maybe we've been in the room once, you know. And if you were to be with us, you would have assumed, you know, we've been hanging out since we were high school students. We don't even have language to describe that kind of friendship, you know. But I just think social media reflects us. Mm-hmm. And we need to own it. It doesn't, listen, Twitter has some work to do.
I was going to ask. Yeah.
These tech companies, Facebook, Google, and Google gets away because it's able to distance itself from YouTube. But like, remember that that's all there.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Instagram,
it's theirs.
Facebook, for example.
Right.
These are nation states. These are nation states. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, has more influence than most national leaders, most world leaders, okay? And I think, you know, we need to treat them as such, and they need to be treated as such. All right, Elizabeth Warren, do it, girl. Do it, girl. but beyond that, I think it's human. Whatever's happening there, you know, it's, of course, it's us. And maybe because of the nature of Twitter in particular, which I know the best, you're able to quantify what's,
right.
You know, you can count the Nazis. You know,
right.
As opposed to when we didn't have that, you were just kind of left to what you were anecdotally observing.
Right.
You know, but yeah,
do you have trolls? You ever get confronted by?
Sure.
How do you handle the trolls? Do you feed them or you ignore them?
It depends on the day.
Are you feeling particularly ferocious?
Generally speaking, these trolls. This is what they woke up for. This is, my goodness, these poor people, I fear and pity them, but this is what they woke up for. Mm. This is what they believe they were sent here to do. And like, this is their book, so to speak.
Right.
You're not going to win that. Just like, try to come at me if it's about writing. You know, this is what I was sent here to do. This is my turf. That's how they are. So I try not to engage because I think it's more likely that I'm going to get my feelings hurt or I'm going to mess up. You know, they hit me with the right paper cut. It's like death by a thousand paper cuts,
well,
I make a mistake.
And I think it's remarkable, and I've seen some authors like your friend Roxane Gay. Mm-hmm. She tweeted the other day that somebody hurt her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, that hurt my feelings. I'm a real person.
Yeah.
So when you say mean things to me, that hurts because I'm a human and
sure.
Don't do that. And do you think there's a place for that online? To if this is your personality, this is the type of person you are, you should just put that out there and tell people that hurt my feelings.
Yeah, I think it helps. You know, we're always having to remind, and this is ongoing. You know, I'm not immune to this. We're always having to remind one another of our humanity. You know, and I think, you know, for example, you know, people can look at me and be like, oh, Saeed, he's funny and da-da-da, and he's got a book and everything's going on. And then people start getting a little tougher and a little hard. And I'm like, ow. Yeah, totally. I mean, I've been so sensitive, particularly in the last month or so with this book coming out. That's not just a book, but it's about my mom. It's a personal history.
Right.
That's a lot. And, you know, my friends, like the little jesting and stuff. I'm like, maybe a year ago I could have taken that poke,
right.
You know, but that actually, I'm not ready for that right now. So I think, you know, it's okay to communicate what you need sincerely. Don't weaponize, you know, that hurt. And just
right.
Anytime someone criticizes, I think it's unfair, you know, when people frame any type of criticism as a pylon.
Right.
You know, and everything. And my goodness, let's just be very clear. The only lynch mobs that exist were actually lynch mobs.
Right.
And they were not going after New York Times.
There's no high-tech
reporters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, no. I mean, yeah, it's, don't get me wrong. You know, we all, if you're online long enough, you mess up. How could you not? You are a human, not an algorithm, and they still mess up. But yeah, so the day comes or whatever when you get into it and it gets messy and you get overwhelmed. I understand that. But I think, you know, we have to maintain the perspective. Put
right.
down your phone for a bit and come back. Just because you had a terrible day or miscommunication and happens constantly
right, right.
Doesn't mean the internet is evil, you know, holistically.
Sure. You know, I want to, and I bring that up too. I wonder, you know, looking back at your 12-year-old self, at Saeed, who's, you know, in the apartment and you discover a James Baldwin book, and, mm-hmm. and that's
Another Country.
Another Country, yeah, and it's this new world opening to you. And I just wonder, had you had exposure to social media at that time, would you have found the refuge in books, or would you be online looking for that community?
That's interesting. I mean, I've always been pretty voracious. I mean, you, for better or worse, you see it in the book, right? Right. I was like, whatever, like the gay version of Encyclopedia Brown, you know, like, you know, and part of it was because, you know, if you put your, you know, so many things have changed. It's easy to forget, you know, that there was a point when I was growing up, marriage equality was a dream. The idea that you would be able to marry a person of your same sex when I was growing up in Texas was like a black man becoming president one day. Right? I mean, people used to, because, you know, I did speech and they'd be like, oh, you're so eloquent, you'd be president one day. I'd be like, yeah, shut up. You know, because it was just like, stop it. You know, or a woman becoming president. You know, it was a fantasy. Lawrence v. Texas, the Supreme Court decision that brought an end to anti-sodomy laws. Anti-sodomy laws. You could technically be arrested and charged if police entered your home and you were having sex with a person of the same gender. That's my junior year of high school. So growing up in that environment, it just seemed impossible to, and not worth the risk, to ask questions. You know, what does it mean if you have feelings for, you know? So you see in the book, like, me doing this detective work and trying to figure it out with mixed results. If you add social media to it, yeah, I mean, I would hope to think, I would love little 12-year-old Saeed watching Pose.
Right, yeah.
I would love, you know, mm-hmm. I would love, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race or seeing Billy Porter twirl on the red carpet or, you know, Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, you know, getting Janet Mock, not just thriving as like a writer or like a beautiful woman, because she is so beautiful. I've hung out with her. I've seen her show up for lunch, like riding down the street on a sweaty day, and I'm like, you're the most beautiful woman on the street. Like, I cannot believe it. It's not fair. But she's also closing business deals with Netflix, right. And that's new. Yeah, we should celebrate that, because we're seeing queer people of color as business people, right. And that is world changing, I think, for kids. You know, the moment you get to the point in your life, and I hope everyone in this room is there, where representation means less to you, you know, congratulations. You've made it. You've made it into your whole self. But we have to remember that most people, and certainly young people, until they, you know, get what they need, don't feel that way. Right. Don't feel that way.
This is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams. We're at the Parkway Theater in Minneapolis, and my guest today is Saeed Jones. We're talking about his memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives. There's a sentence in that, in your memoir, that struck me, and a couple sentences, and I want to read it and have you respond. You say that people don't just happen. We sacrifice former versions of ourselves. We sacrifice the people who dared to raise us. Yeah. I want to take some time to unpack that just a little bit. In what ways do you feel like you had to sacrifice the people who loved you and you loved in your life?
One of the ways is secrets. You know, my mother and I had a vibrant, warm relationship. We made each other laugh. We talked about politics. We said, I love you. Though she practiced Nichiren Buddhism and was pretty liberal-leaning and progressive in a lot of ways, homosexuality, queerness, like the education just wasn't there. Right. Just wasn't there. And so it was a silence for us. And her mother, my grandmother Mildred, has lived in Memphis, Tennessee her entire life. She was one of the first black nurses in the city. My grandfather's one of the first black public bus drivers, right. And is very conservative and devoutly Christian. And so that kind of formed this crucible. And, you know, my family was, I feel, is a matriarchy, right. Which is good. A matriarchy is good. But all that's to say, you know, for different reasons, talking about this aspect of my identity, which was, you know, essential. Sex is kind of important, as it turns out. It just didn't work. You know, came up, it was never good. And usually I wouldn't even, and I think about this with young people. Don't just assume they're okay. Because often, as someone who's taught and been a young person, I've noticed is that young people often assume you won't even be cool. You won't even, accept their question. So they get to a point where they can become so anxious where they stop asking questions. And so, yeah, I think one way I sacrificed my relationships with the people who raised me was I stopped being my whole self with them.
Right.
Because I felt I had to. It makes me very sad because I don't know if I was entirely right. Maybe it, my mother in particular, maybe it would have been difficult. And you see us kind of at different points in the book, like trying to.
I know some of that was, it was hard to read that. I mean, you're having these conversations when you first actually came out to mm-hmm. your mom.
I come out my freshman year of college.
Yeah. And she kind of says, okay, I'll talk to you later. And you have another conversation. Mm-hmm. And then you feel afterwards, you say something to the effect of, I realized that I came out to her, but not as myself.
Yep.
What did you mean by that?
Well, because, I'm going through a lot in this little here book called How We Fight for Our Lives, available wherever books are sold. But one thing you don't see me struggling with is, like, am I gay? Am I attractive to boys? Yeah. I've always known Marlon Brando was fine. That's just factual. I knew what I felt.
Right.
It just, I think I've always had, I will never work in politics, because, but I think I've always had a somewhat political mind. Mm-hmm. I remember in high school thinking, I can't come out, because some girls were coming out. Mm-hmm. I remember my prom date actually had come out a year before, and I'd come out to her personally,
right,
privately. But I remember thinking my junior year, I can't come out because I want to be National Honor Society president next year. Which is both deeply funny. isn't that like a plot on Glee at some point, right? But also deeply sad.
Right.
Because that implies a calculus. That's not me being like, I wonder if. It's me being like, nope.
Just not the time.
It's saying yes to myself will mean saying no to goals and dreams. And so that's the politicking, which right. sucks. That's awful. You can't politic who you are. Or you shouldn't. The cost is too high. So, yeah, that's something that I think made me sad. And, yeah, with my mom, the other thing is, and this – I actually hear people talk about this a lot, mm-hmm. coming out to family members. And maybe it's okay. Like, the conversation with my mom's actually pretty positive in a lot of ways.
Right.
She was like, you sound happy, and that's what matters to me. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, my gosh, And then it's as if we both go back into the closet.
Right.
In the years that follow, every time, because now I'm like, okay, well, now we can talk about boys, because though I am gay, men are trash. Just absolute garbage. When people are like, being gay is a choice, is it? Is it? Because I love women, and I think I would be far happier if I was in a relationship with a woman or a gender non-binary person. But, the heart wants what it wants. And so I remember being like, I have questions
right.
about this boy I'm dating. Like, right. I don't get it.
And you want advice from your mom.
I want advice from my mom. Right. And every time I would try to bring it up in different ways, I admit we were watching the news and his brother was fighting in the Iraq War. Shout out to George W. Bush, who's having a renaissance. Be kind.
Yeah.
I mentioned that my boyfriend's brother was a veteran to my mom as a way to kind of bring it up. And I described a scene like that in the book. And it was like, I'm just talking. And I was aware of the stakes because I remember I was like looking down, trying to be chill, keep your voice calm as I'm like casually, bringing this up. And I looked at my mom. And I describe her as someone who's afraid of heights being led to the edge of a bridge.
Right.
She just looked like she was pleading with me, like, please, not cruel, not bigoted. And that word, like, I'm like, who's bigoted? And she just looked terrified and aware that, that joke, like, so-and-so has the range, like, she didn't have the range. And I think she was deeply ashamed of it.
Wow.
And I think it made her sad. And so I did what I think we often do, is we disappear right in front of our loved ones. Mm. And we say, I love you so much, I'm not going to make you do this thing you don't want to do.
She's scared for you. It sounded like she was worried.
Also
she feared
that.
About, your safety and about your health.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that is Whew. I mean, and I try to, you know, this book is how we fight for our lives. Because yes, it is my story, but I did want to make space for the nuance of recognizing that my mother is fighting for her life in the book. My grandmother, other people, even people who physically harm me in the book are fighting for their lives as well. And, you know, who can begrudge a black mother or a black grandmother or the parent of a daughter, anyone, for saying this country that I am sending my child or grandchild out into is terrifying? How do I arm them? You know, how do I prepare them for this tough world? They're so beautiful and sweet and naive and innocent in this world. My goodness, you know, and I think the parts of the book that really break my heart are where you see how loved ones can mangle one another doing something they believe is preparing the other person for the world.
Right. You know, I want to get to a section of the book for you to read for us. It comes from when you're in high school and there's a production at school. Mm-hmm. Just give us a little bit of the context. What led to this particular...
I grew up in Lewisville High School. It's a suburb, middle-class suburb, just north of Dallas, about 20 minutes north of Dallas up Highway I-35. We are Lewisville, Texas, home of the Lewisville High School Fighting Farmers. For a little bit of context. So just, I think that kind of like says it all, you know, just like, oh, okay. You're gay? Yes.
You were fighting
crime. I was navigating those hallways. So, you know, and it was a big, big school. It was like 2,000 students. So just for context. And the other thing is I mentioned James Byrd Jr. James Byrd Jr., and you see this in the opening chapters of the book, James Byrd Jr. was a black man, middle-aged, working class, in Jasper, Texas, which was about 4 hours from where I lived. He accepted a ride home in June of 1998 from three white men who turned out to be white supremacists. And there was like a gas station parking lot, and he was like, the walk home is just really long. And so he accepted a ride home from them. They beat him up. When he was passed out, they chained him to the back of the truck and dragged him until his body came apart. It was horrendous, horrendous. I don't mention in the book, but actually his body, I don't know if you know this, when he was buried in Jasper, Texas, 1998, he desegregated the cemetery.
That I didn't know.
Yeah. And so I mentioned James Byrd Jr. because he is killed in 1998, and I describe watching it on the news with my mom. Right. You know, Oprah was in Texas at the point, actually did a show about it, you know. And then that October, Matthew Shepard is killed. This past, I think, Sunday, October 6th, at 11 p.m. was technically the 21st anniversary of the evening Matthew Shepard meets those two guys at a bar in Laramie, Wyoming, and they beat him and leave him for dead, and he died a few days later. So all of that is swirling about the home of the Fighting Farmers. Okay. Spring 2002, Lewisville, Texas. My English teacher interrupted the beginning of class just as we were taking our seats and digging out our books. In a few minutes, she said, the school's theater department would be performing an abbreviated version of a play called The Laramie Project. It would be an all-school assembly and take up most of our class time. Smirks and pleased whispers at that last detail. The teacher raised her voice, reminding us to be mature and thoughtful. But she did not explain why the reminder was needed. I knew, though. Hearing my teacher say Laramie was like watching a grenade bounce across the floor of our classroom. I tried to read my classmates' faces without changing the bored expression on my own. I did my best to mirror the easy shoulder shrugs and grinning relief I saw around me as we streamed out into the hallway. The Laramie Project was a series of monologues based on interviews in the weeks after the murder of Matthew Shepard. He was a gay 21-year-old man who had been brutally killed by two strangers he'd met one night in Laramie, Wyoming. I remember the moment I had heard about it, watching the news at home with Mom, only a few months after we sat on the same couch and watched reports about James Byrd Jr.'s murder. A photograph of Matthew, skinny, blonde, smiling, was displayed while the details of the case were discussed. I remember thinking he looked sweet, hopelessly gentle, the kind of kid I would hang around with after school, but only when I knew people weren't around. Watching the news, I thought I could feel my mother turning to look at me, so I'd gotten up and walked out of the living room as if I was bored. She didn't say anything about it that night. The word gay was still unspoken in the house, an increasingly eloquent, encompassing silence. By the time Matthew Shepard's life and death made it to the classrooms of my high school in 2002, my feelings about him and James Byrd Jr. had started to swirl and converge. I was walking through a dusty, fluorescent-lit hallway halfway to the assembly hall, trying with every filament of my body to look cool, when the two truths finally collided. Being black can get you killed. Being gay can get you killed. Being a black gay boy is a death wish. And one day, if you are lucky, your life and death will become some artist's new project. As the house lights dimmed, I sighed, relieved to be invisible again. Sitting in the dark just before the stage lit up, I heard, or thought I heard, a senior in the row ahead of me say something about a dead gay boy. He turned to his friend, maybe to deliver a punchline, or maybe not. Their backs were to me, so I couldn't tell what they thought about this dead gay boy. Within just a few minutes of the play, some of the girls on my row were sobbing. A few held one another's hands. The monologues were heart-shattering. I envied the girls who felt comfortable enough to cry. How easily they breathed. All the boys near me looked indifferent. I would think later that maybe some of them were only pretending to be indifferent. Maybe some could only sit comfortably, whisper ironically, laugh audibly with total effort. For me, it took all I had to sit silent and still. I wanted to be on that stage, speaking the words I still didn't feel safe enough to say on my own. One of the last monologues the students performed was in the voice of Matthew Shepard's father. He was speaking to the two convicted murderers during their sentencing hearing. Dennis Shepard, an oil industry safety engineer, offered them a stern mercy. Instead of the death penalty, he asked for a life sentence, as Matthew would have wanted, he said. He prayed for the killers, or perhaps cursed them, to think about Matthew every day for the rest of their lives. The girl sitting right next to me let her head drop to her chest as if felled. She shook her head back and forth, crying softly. It repulsed me then, her freedom. The actor on stage continued his monologue. As best I could, I pushed the words away while keeping my eyes on him. The spotlight made his tear-filled eyes glimmer. And I sat there in the dark, trying to ignore a second girl, now sobbing right next to me. I tuned out the words he spoke for fear that if I let myself pay attention to them, I would start crying too. I would start sobbing and not be able to stop, not until long after the house lights came up. But then the house lights did come up, and I slipped on the forcefully carefree posture of the other boys around me. The existential shrug of young men afraid to admit that they have been touched by art and that they want to be touched that way again.
Hey, 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 hey. Three cheers for the late bloomer. Weaving in and out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Three cheers for the late bloomer. Weaving in and out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Oh, really, what's the point? End of the day, end of the week, finish this joint. I got a couple dozen problems, nobody's gonna solve them, ain't no money gonna solve them. I play my cards right, lay my head to sleep, guardian angel spending overtime on me, but this ain't where I need to be. But I needed it, message been received and I still dream about it. Three cheers for the late bloomer. We've been in and out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Oh, three cheers for the late bloomer. We've been in and out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Oh, breathe, begin to fly above the lows. I might just meet you, said breathe, begin to fly above the lows. I might just meet you. Three cheers, three cheers, three cheers for the late bloomer, the late bloomer, oh, late bloomer, oh, oh. Three cheers, yeah, three cheers, three cheers for the late bloomer. Begin to fly above the lows. I might just meet you, said breathe, begin to fly above the lows. I might just meet you. Three cheers for the late bloomer. Weaving in and out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Three cheers for the late bloomer. Weaving out of traffic with the system booming. They'll be saying how they knew you to the local news and screaming hallelujah, she's about to do it. Oh, breathe, begin to fly above the lows. I might just meet you. Three cheers.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, K Radio, everybody.
Wonderful. Three cheers indeed.
This is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams. We're at the Parkway Theater here in Minneapolis, and my guest is Saeed Jones. We're talking about his new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives. You know, I'm one of the appeals of this show that I enjoy about Talking Volumes is that we get a chance to kind of peer underneath your cap there to
sure
see
you
what you
to?
Know
okay.
about the writing process, what you go through,
yeah.
And also what you are you able to like have time to read while you're out on tour right now?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I thought about it.
So you didn't
maybe
bring any
it'll
books
change.
With you?
No.
Okay.
Just mine.
Just yours.
No, it's you know, because it's funny. I'm willing to go there on the page. You know, I go and then later, you know, when readers come to me and talk about things that resonated with them, or, you know, when I recorded the audiobook for this, and that was really cool, and it felt like a different, then I'm like, oh my. Ooh, that was a little intense. That was a little honest.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that.
I need time on the road to compress. I can't read.
Well, yeah. The audiobook is, there's a difference between reading the words and having them read to you. And I'm curious about how it felt for you to read your words as somebody will be listening to them.
Well, a few notes. You know, one thing, it's one thing to write a sex scene. Another thing to read it.
There are a few of those in the book.
Yeah, there are. There are. We actually cut a few chapters. And my editor at one point was like, I got to be. And he's wonderful. He's like, after all this, I ended up getting edited by a wonderful straight white man. So, you know, go figure. But he was like, I think we've got enough sex. I think we're, I don't think, he said very diplomatically, I don't think we're learning anything from this sex. Speak for yourself. So that was one thing, just like, huh, dialogue, and there's something I'm going to read in a little bit that's an example of this, where painful things were said. I found, you know, to have those words come out of my mouth, mm-hmm. to feel the air moving through my throat and out of my lips was hard.
Right.
Was difficult. And I would not have known that. I wouldn't have known that as a writer. I kind of keep my head down, you know? And so then, yeah, engaging the book was different as a reader. I did it quickly.
Right.
In because a lot's going on. I did it in 2 days. So we did the book basically in 2 halves, I think, roughly. And so, sitting alone in a little, you know, little studio, and then there's two people outside the room, and it's different. And the book, water is an important image for me. You will notice it manifest in my book often. Waves, repetition, you know, three mm-hmm. cheers, what begins to happen, you know, mm-hmm. that is a part of my writing process. And so, I think it's so natural now that it happens and I don't notice it. And certainly right. working on a book so big. So only when I was reading it did I start noticing some of the waves of details or things. And certainly like Matthew Shepard and James Burt Jr. I mean, this is how memories work, right? Right. You have an experience and then you go on and it comes back. And then the way you're experiencing it in the real moment kind of bounces you and you're kind of doing that. So reading it out loud, I felt for the first time, working on this book for a decade, for the first time I felt and understood why readers have been coming to me and being like, this was a gut punch of a book.
Right.
You know, or one former coworker was like, I've gotten to the end of the book. And I was like, oh. And I was like, where are you? And she was like, I'm on the train. And I was like, stop, don't do it. You know, she was like, why? And I was like, because people, I was like, I'm not trying to brag, but people are like, I'm sobbing reading the end of the book. So right. I was like, don't read it in public. And then, you know, she went silent. And then an hour later, Saeed! You know, she couldn't resist. And I was like, I told you!
Right.
You know? But so only when I read it myself, saying it out loud, and I think, of course, obviously enacting words is a transformative act.
Well, yeah, I wonder, did you edit on the fly as you're reading your, because maybe these things didn't roll off your tongue as well, the way you wrote them?
No, because, I mean, when I worked really hard on this book, so no, I wasn't editing on the fly. Brent? No, but also because, you know, I am a poet, and so a natural part of my writing process is to begin reading the work out loud. And again, that's different because I'm reading a paragraph or a few sentences to hear how it's working.
Right.
I'm not really thinking about the content. But yeah, I would, read out loud, you know, the little sections as I would go. This is a book of prose, but the lyricism was important in part because I'm a pretty matter of fact prose writer.
Right.
You know, I'm just like, this is what happened, you know? And so I think I use the lyricism and the images and the sound that come from the poetry tradition to color out the nuances. So the reader isn't just like, he went through it, but he is ice cold. Like, what's going on?
Well, you described your it's almost being dispassionate in a way as you write, you're like, mm-hmm. no, this is what it is. I'm putting it down but the listening, when you spoke those words, they struck you differently.
Yeah, they did. Because you know, I mean, one, the book is, you know, it's so big. I'm used to writing poems, so I describe the difference as, you know, poetry is like microbiology. You're studying organisms. Writing a memoir felt like being a world historian. You're still studying organisms. That's what history is, right? But it's just the scale is so different. And so, yeah, I mean, I would, like, the New York Times glowing review came out the other day. Fresh Air is even better. Thank you, Fresh Air. Thank you. I always say own your joy. Own your joy. You worked hard for it. but a reader identified a line, thank you, that's quoted in the New York Times review. And it was a sentence I forgot I wrote. And I was like, it's incredible. It was like, it is possible for two men to become addicted to the hurt they can cause one another. And I was like, that is...
Well, who wrote that?
Oh, no. My. You know, because it's just... The book is so big and, you know, you're just trying to get from trying to basically survive one round of edits to the next and whatever. And, you know, writing the Laramie Project scene, it was really difficult. It required a lot of work for me to remember and think about how I felt. It's changing from moment to moment. How did you feel when the teacher said it? What did you do next? I would have looked around the classroom. Okay, where do you go? You're going down the hall. Like really doing that. That's enough work that I'm not thinking about the lyricism in the moment.
Right.
But then someone quotes a line back to me and I'm like, oh, wow. Huh. Yeah.
That just sounds like, I mean, that process of going back and living through these memories. I mean, obviously there are some that were obviously more vivid that you still hold on to, right, that you could, mm-hmm, recite.
Some memories are burned into you. That is
exactly
true.
Yes. Exactly. But then there are others in this book where it sounds like you had to, like you just describing, that, mm-hmm, you had to imagine yourself back in that classroom. Mm-hmm. Where would you have looked to? Where, right, have you turned? I'm wondering, how do you, then when you present this to an editor, mm-hmm, did they say to you, well, I don't know if that sounds like it really happened that way? Would they, did you get any pushback from your editors on this, like, this doesn't seem credible? Would you, you know, were there any scenes like that in the book?
Let me honestly answer your question. I
appreciate that.
Thank you. Yes, you know, we're ethical journalism here. It is still here, still here. Most journalists are doing a good job, guys, you know. Until recently, I was working at BuzzFeed News while this was happening. So I worked at BuzzFeed News as the LGBT editor. Surprise. A professional gay. and then I was the executive editor of Culture, and I've done different things, and, you know, at my responsibility peak, I was managing something like 20 people.
Right.
The books desk, the LGBT desk, podcast, different teams, culture writers and everything. So all that's to say, I've been in a newsroom, you know, for a majority of the time that I was working on this, surrounded by wonderful journalists doing crucial work. And let's open it up to, you know, my joke, but, you know, I've been surrounded by this conversation about news and ethics and the truth, you know, and yeah, it acts upon you, and I'm grateful for it. Mm-hmm. Because, and I said in an interview the other day, I was like, a quickly written memoir is a memoir full of lies. Mm-hmm. You know, I wrote this book slowly, in part because I was working and everything, but in part because I really tried to take the time necessary to remember what actually happened. So my editor didn't do that.
Okay.
Because I think he was aware that I was honestly wearing myself out. And then also, like, place is really important in my work. In my poetry, everything's grounded. I don't like words that are just like, where's this poem taking place? In the white space. It's like, no, I want a poem to have dirt or, right, water or whatever. So I did not interview people for the book because I was like, this book is a product of my memory and I'm an unreliable narrator and the reader will know that. Mm-hmm. The way we deceive ourselves is an important idea when you're talking about identity. So I didn't want to hide that with interviews. But I did go back to almost every physical location in the book. You know, I went back to Lewisville, Texas. I went back to my high school, walked around. And I was like, I'm here to speak to the children. I wasn't there to speak to the children. I care about those children.
You're doing some book
reading. I was there to be like, I'm right. This is what the hallway looked like. This was what it smelled like. I went and drove back to my apartment complex where my mom and I lived when we were in Lewisville and sat in front of it. Wow. And was like, oh yeah, that was an oak tree. I'm right. You know, so that helped. Okay. And I think going, well, where would, you know, the teacher says X and then you walk, where would you go? Like that kind of what would you do in this box, this space, and then the next space? What does it sound like when you sit in the theater and the wooden chairs? You know, what would you be doing while you're waiting for it to begin?
Right.
That's kind of how I guided my creative mind through what I hoped was a pretty ethical, you know, retelling.
Give me a sense of the difference for you between writing poetry and prose in this regard, because this is
totally different.
Yeah, and
totally different.
Walk us through that.
Poetry, you know, and I mentioned at one point that the earliest poems I wrote, I was like stray phrases that I wrote down when I was tired of repeating them to myself. That's kind of where poems start. I have an image, usually like the first line or the title. There's a poem in Prelude to Bruise called Post-Apocalyptic Heartbeat. And I wrote that phrase down in my notebook in graduate school and didn't successfully write the poem until 3 years later. So I mean, just last week I had a line that I have had in my notebook for 4 years. And when it happens, I just write in my notebook refrain, colon, and then the line again, so that as I'm looking, I can see like clearly there, it's coming back. So don't give up on it, but you know, it'll wait. And so once the music is in tune, so to speak, I write. And then I go. And so when I write poetry, if you can imagine it, I write the first line, get to the end, right? And I go to the second line and I try to finish it and I mess up. The tune goes, you know, and I draw a little dash. I write the first line. I write what I hope is a better version of the second line. Maybe I make it to the third line. Draw a dash, start over. That's how I write poetry. That's how I started writing the memoir.
Wow.
So that's why the music's in it. That's why I'm head down. But also, I don't know where I'm going. All I'm trying to do is survive the feeling, you know? I have no idea with poetry how it's going to end, which is why my poems tend to be pretty suspenseful. If you've read like Prelude to Bruise, you're kind of like, oh my gosh, turn the page, because what happens next? You don't, because I didn't know. That is a genuine part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I like it. I've come to, you know, so Prelude to Bruise, which follows a character named Boy, you know, for me, I was like, I finish a poem and go, oh my goodness, what happens next? And then I write another poem, which helped me keep writing, you know, because poetry, you have to face the blank page a lot more frequently. And that's, it's hard to start over. So the concern and the, you know, would give me a, well, what happened the next night? You know, that's the next poem. So that's great and really fun. I recommend you try it as a writing strategy if you like poetry. You can't write a memoir like that.
No.
Can you imagine how quickly you're like, okay, so I'm going to write about this classroom scene. Next thing you know, you're like on Mars. Like, you're like way over, because it sounded good or an image came, you know, like it's just a totally different thing. And in poetry, that's, it's jazz. You know, I think of jazz as, you know, classically trained, like Nina Simone referred to her music as like black classical music. It's not raw. I don't like the word raw to describe art. My book is not raw. I worked very hard to craft this book, right? But, you know, you study the craft, you develop the discipline, and that frees you then to intuitively respond to, oh, and go with it. And so that's poetry. Prose and certainly memoir, the ethics of it and the intention of it require me to know where I'm going.
Right.
Why are you in this classroom, you know, scene, and why does this matter at all? Why does it matter that you know, I'm seeing a school play? Why does it matter that I'm describing these girls crying so much, right? There's so much description of what's going on around me, because I need you to understand that is a reflection of my isolation. You know, only when you are so isolated, you know, there's no friend where I'm like, well, girl, what do you think about this? You know, and this guy, and he cute, you know, no, I'm totally alone and just click, 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 like a camera observing and reading every moment. I mean, it makes me think when you're mentioning like Tim O'Brien and you know, I think of, you know, Brian Turner, wonderful poet, who's also a war veteran. When veterans, you know, it's click, click, click. You know, right. When you're in a landscape of total peril, that's what's going on. You're just observing and you.
Right. You're seeing it in snapshots. You're seeing these things that are burned into you that you, and you recall that so well in the book. I mean, there are certain, I mean, you can feel it's especially
a high school student at war.
Well, yeah.
What it feels like.
Or a high school student going to an assembly where you're dealing with something where, as you, in, like, the young boys are just like, eh.
Whatever.
No big deal.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Whatever. And that was, I remember that detail was a line of discovery. You know, I think the first, and, you know, drafts, you get better, you know, I mean, you have a good editor. Oh my gosh. Like when you praise this book, and I hope you do, you know, I want you to know Jonathan Cox, my editor in Simon & Schuster, is just one of the most brilliant people I've ever gotten to work with. You can't do this alone. You know, even if you're a very talented writer, you need someone outside of yourself to, you know, do it. But I remember the first time I wrote it, I described the indifference of all the boys. Mm-hmm. And then maybe he pointed it out, maybe based on our conversations about it, he was like, were they indifferent? Are you sure? You know, so actually maybe that was an example of pushback. And then I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I don't know. I don't know how these boys felt because we didn't talk about our feelings. I was in my terror.
Right.
Making assumptions. And maybe my assumptions are right. I think I'm a pretty intuitive person. I'm good at reading the room, generally speaking, but maybe not, you know? And that to me is actually more interesting than me just describing a scene and all the boys in the room are jerks. It's like, oh no, it's complicated. Like maybe they are, you know, shouldering their own burdens.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. This is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams. I'm here at the Parkway Theater in Ludlay, South Minneapolis, along Chicago Avenue. I'm here with Saeed Jones. We're talking about his new memoir, How We Fight for Our Lives. And speaking of writing a memoir, you're 33. Why write a memoir now?
Because of the intention. You know, I had a very specific goal in mind with this book, and I wanted to capture it, which was, you know, what are the costs of being made to feel that you cannot be your whole self? What does that do to you over time? Like, how does that silence and shame metastasize? You know, the beginning of the book is actually pretty subtle. You know, it's like, oh, good relationship with his mom, and he seems to be a good student, and da-da-da. But on the other level, there's this silence that's developing and churning, and it gets out of control, you know? And so by the middle, you're like, ah, you know, like, ah. So, and I think that's important. You know, I think we have this idea that, one, if you're not a straight white man named Jonathan Franzen, basically, that's who I'm talking about. I'm talking about Jonathan Franzen.
Let's be honest.
You're basically not one of those literary bros. We've all dated them. We've all dated the guy who likes walking around with his copy of David Foster Wallace. We get it. Charles Bukowski, okay. If you're not framed or perceived as that, right. Everyone else has to justify their story. Everyone else. Why are you doing this? You know, they don't ask them that. And so, you know, I felt like I wanted to push back against that and say, no, like it doesn't. And what happens often is that it's like, well, what's your trauma? What happened to you that was so bad to just, how wild and crazy is you think of, you know? And yes, it does get a little wild and crazy, but I wanted to make space for the more subtle moments, the more subtle spaces that define really 99% of our lives. Our daily experiences aren't usually at a 10. I hope not, right? Usually we're like down at a nice 3 or 4. You turn on the news and you're at a 5. I get it. Okay. But like what's going on down at that other level? You know, and like I mentioned, you know, yes, there are moments of straight up terror and peril in this book where it's like, no, actually, you are physically in danger. You are actually fighting for your life. It has ceased to be a metaphor, Saeed. Get out of the room, right? That happens a few times, right? But yeah. What happens when you are actually not in physical danger, but the hurt is real? Mm-hmm. You're with loved ones, but the hurt is real, you know? And if we only think the stories that are like operating at a 10 in terms of peril are worth being thoughtful about, then we are missing, you know, a huge range of the human experience. So it's actually, in a way, a different kind of diversity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, you know, in selecting those parts of your life to write about, mm-hmm. and looking forward, I mean, I'll just ask you, are you planning on writing maybe another memoir someday?
Oh, God, I hope not.
No?
I don't know. Who's to say?
Well, I just wonder, because, I mean, are you going to, like, are there certain moments that you've had since you finished this where you're like, boy, this might make a nice, you know, chapter for my next memoir?
I mean, one, you know, I've got to be honest, you kind of see in the book, I have that tendency. You know, there's a scene in the book where, I mean, and I basically, I'm lucky to have walked out of that room alive, but I walk into that space and something happens, or like a door is locked, basically, and it's like, not good. And I swear to you, I would testify on the stand. My first thought was, maybe I'll get a poem out of it. You know, my interest as a writer in like, oh, that's interesting. What's going on there? Mm-hmm. For so long has kept me in a dangerous space or dynamic longer than was reasonable. So knowing that, having written about what happens when you do that long enough, I think I've resisted the like, I could write about this moment, you know, when I'm like, yeah, maybe, but how do you feel about this moment?
Yeah.
You know, maybe I will write a memoir. I don't know. That's not on my mind right now. You know, when I published Prelude to Bruise, the poetry collection, I was like in Next Up, you know, like right. That experience writing poems, about identity, that are, you know, kind of more allegorical. It's a black gay boy in the South, but his life is very different from mine and he grows up and has a relationship with his father and I do not, you know, very different. The experience of publishing those poems and sharing them with readers prepared me. Like the compassion, like I mentioned, oh my gosh, what happens next? I was like, well, maybe you should be asking that about yourself, you know? And that's when I knew I was ready to write the memoir. Now, in terms of what comes next, I mean, I love nonfiction, so, you know, but I think I'm more interested in what I will be empowered to do. Now that I think, you know, for better or worse, I think I didn't write a terrible book. I think we're okay. Yeah, you know, I think I will be invited to write a book again, you know, which is not an assumption everyone can make. So like knowing that, and like some people will read it, you know, every time I get good news, you know, because this is all different, publishing a poetry collection and then publishing, like, you know, it's just a totally different experience.
Right.
I have to ask, like, the public, what does it mean? Like, yay, this is good. I'm like, what does it mean? You know, and they're like, this is what it means to get a good New York Times review. You know, this is the stakes. And it's like, oh, okay.
There you go.
Oh, right. You know, so I'm more interested in what I can use that capital to do next.
Right.
You know, like, every time I see Beyonce, you know, thrill us again, you know, confirm yet again that it is not a fluke. It is consistent excellence, you know, or Rihanna, because she in that wonderful Vogue interview today, read it. What she says about football is really interesting. I'm thrilled because I go, well, what are they going to be able to do next? They've proven themselves, you know, and they got more capital. So that empowers them to demand more, right. Expect more. And, you know, and that's why it just keeps getting more exciting. So I want to, not that, oh my God, I just compared myself to Beyonce and Rihanna. But you know, that's where I am, you
yeah.
know?
Well,
that's where I am. Well, oh,
speaking of the memoir, I do want to, I do want to have you read another
sure.
section of the memoir, and we're going to, in a little bit of the setup here,
yeah.
we're going back to, this is the passage you were talking about that kind of hurt on its way out. And,
yeah.
But I felt it was really powerful. And I will tell you that when I was reading it, mm-hmm. there were a few sentences where I was talking back to the book.
Oh, I love like, that.
That was, it's one of those types of scenes. So we'll give you a little, and there's a few more of those in the book as well, but I want you to read, from this section and give us a little setup about, your experience
yeah.
at church with your grandmother.
Yeah. I curse books out. I throw yep. them across the room. That's when it's real good. That's when we're like, you know, like, no, you didn't. I can't believe. You know, that's wonderful. So, you know, my mom, a single mom, both sides of my family are from Memphis, Tennessee. When I was growing up, you know, if you're a parent, you know, it's very expensive. Like, your kids being on vacation is just like, what do we do? Oh no. You know, they're going to eat all the food and use all the electricity and just drive you crazy, you know? And so my mom, as many, I think, parents do, they, you know, she would send me back to Memphis to be with my grandma every summer. That was just the rhythm. And, you know, my mom comes from a very Christian conservative family, and she started practicing Nichiren Buddhism in her 20s, which was like, explosive, you know, and so I, you know, some of my earliest memories, or one of them rather, is me, you know, being short, small enough to sit under a table, and I just remember seeing the bottom of the adult's feet,
right,
as they were having an argument And I have to assume it was about religion. And I remember it just like their legs just kind of looked like tornadoes, like my uncle and my grandmother and my mom just kind of yelling and moving around the room. And I was just watching. So it was like it was like war. It was a religious war, I felt like, in our family. And then by the time I, you know, come up and you meet Young Sight in the book, it's kind of a cold war. The feelings have intensified, yeah. But there's just, it's ruled by this silence and this, everyone's pretending they're not really angry and hurt, you know, and so what you see in this chapter and you're seeing when it comes to a head, is the realization I think that some of my grandmother had was that she needed to save my soul. She had lost her daughter as she perceived it. And I think she was aggrieved, broken hearted. I mean, think about it. If you really believe, you know, this doctrine, you know, and you love your daughter and you believe she's going to hell, like that is, I think that would wake you up in the morning and put you back to bed at night, you know? And so she just really passionately tries to save me with mixed results. Mm. And this is at the end of a whole summer of basically going to church four nights a week. So, you know, she was like, you're going to get this God today. That's kind of what's been going on. At the end of the service that night, the preacher stepped out from behind the podium and spread his arms. I didn't see the preacher's smile. I saw the oil on his nose and the beads of sweat on his neck. He always did this. He would stand with his arms spread wide open until someone walked to the front of the room, sobbing audibly. Come to the pulpit. Let us pray together. He said it with the same tone he had used for the last few weeks, three nights a week. He tried to sound like this was spontaneous, like he had just been standing there and could suddenly feel us asking for prayer. I had come to develop an odd fondness for this moment because it meant that the night was almost over. Soon, my grandmother and I would be driving back home. She caught my eyes, and I noticed that her eyes were shining, like she was about to cry. I should add, we'd had a fight earlier that day. Her hand was on my hand. She was holding my hand. I thought she was about to lean forward and apologize. I smiled. She pulled me to my feet. My body felt hot, then numb. We were moving toward the front of the room. People were craning their necks to watch us as we passed them. People were applauding, saying amen. I tried to pull away, but my grandmother would not let go of my hand. When we got to the pulpit, the preacher was wiping sweat from his face with a handkerchief. He got on his knees, and we did the same, my grandmother pulling me down to the floor. I could have set that room on fire. Then she said what she had been saying all summer. This is my grandson, Saeed. His mother is Buddhist. The preacher nodded, like this was all he would ever need to know about me. Not that I held my books like a girl. Not that I was worldly. Not that I collected pictures of Mark Wahlberg in those Calvin Klein ads. He started to pray out loud for the entire church to hear. Dear God, hear me, praying for one of your lambs. His mother has chosen the path of Satan and decided to pull him down too. I was dizzy. It felt like all the lights in the room were on me. I wondered what my back looked like to the people in the pews. My head was bowed. I probably looked like I was crying. I wanted to turn around and scream out that I was not my mother's fault. Fight back, God. Make her suffer. The word her hit me. If only I could grab the fire blazing through me and hold on to it long enough to roar back at this man, who are you? I know you aren't talking about my mother. But I couldn't do it. I kept my head down, stunned and silent. I felt my knees wobble as if I might fall onto my side. Put every ailment, every disease on her until she breaks under the weight of the Holy Spirit. I turned my head slightly and looked at my grandmother. My mother had a heart condition. When I was 5, she had been on the list for a heart transplant. My grandmother knew all of this. She knew her daughter's heart. Her head was bowed and her eyes were closed. She was frowning, but I couldn't tell if it was because of me or him. This man was cursing her daughter. Her daughter. The body that linked our bodies. Show her your plagues and save this child. Amen. Amen. The preacher was finished and my grandmother quietly thanked him. I couldn't think of anything to say, so I just stared at her. My mouth was opened and my eyes were wide, bewildered, stinging. She took my hand and patted it and slowly rose to her feet. She had a bit of trouble standing up then. I'll never forget that tiny stumble. So I helped her regain her footing. For a moment, my grandmother disappeared back into herself. She was just an old black lady again, soft-spoken, meek, even. Then the spell broke. She dug around in her purse, found her keys, and stepped down from the pulpit without looking at me. I watched one person after another pat her back and shake her hand as she made her way down the aisle and out of the room. I don't remember following her. The memory begins to flicker like a broken film reel here. It burns itself blank, and then we are in my grandmother's car. The windows were rolled down because her AC had been broken all summer. A breeze drifted into the car, then slipped away as if it knew to leave us alone. I kept my eyes on the road ahead of us, yellow line after yellow line, passing, while I clung to the only grace I knew that evening, that the summer would end and I would leave Memphis, that I would never come back, never spend another summer with my grandmother. This fact was as palpable as the silence.
Gonna be late if I don't wake myself up out of this here bed. Still I wait and hesitate to do so. So many thoughts in my head. Question, to put it bluntly, what the hell do I do wrong? What the hell do I do right? Guess I'll find out within this song. Pressure, darling, pressure. Like a diamond in the rough. Oh, pressure, darling, pressure. Welcome forgiveness. Well, that's enough. Well, that's enough. Well, that's enough. Well, that's enough. Oh.
memories faded, some have drifted, and some are gone. Morning, the hit is so harsh, tend to forget your gentle dawn. Oh, pressure, darling, pressure, like a diamond in the rough. Oh, pressure, darling, pressure, welcome forgiveness, well, that's enough. Oh, pressure, 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 darling, pressure, like a diamond in the rough. Oh, pressure, darling, pressure, welcome forgiveness, well, that's enough, well, that's enough. Well, that's enough. Well, that's enough. Thank you.
Great. That's Kay Radio. Thank you, Kay Radio.
Wonderful.
And this is Talking Volumes. I'm Brant Williams. We're at the Parkway Theater with Saeed Jones. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
If you want to get a book signed, come down to the stage. Thank you, Saeed Jones.
Thank you.
That was poet and author Saeed Jones speaking with NPR reporter Brant Williams at Talking Volumes. To learn more about the series and upcoming events, just search for NPR News and Talking Volumes.